Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, featuring influencers, creatives, and thought leaders in the Twin Cities. And now, here is our host, Steve LeBall.
Welcome to Synapse Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau, and we have an awful lot of talk today about intelligence, artificial intelligence. I've always been an advocate for the real thing, but I guess the artificial thing is the up-and-coming thing. We have three people that looking at it in different ways. We have futurist Cecily Summers with us. And what's the name of your book?
Think Like a Futurist.
Think Like a Futurist. I'll have to see if any artificial intelligence can think like futurists.
Yes. Think Like a Futurist. Know what changes, what doesn't. And what's next?
Okay. What's next is Scott Littman's here. He's an entrepreneur, a serial entrepreneur of great acclaim here in the Twin Cities. He's the, give me your title.
So I'm the co-founder of Equals Three, current venture, as well as the co-founder of the Minnesota Cup.
Right. So he has a double hats to wear. And congratulations on the latest Minnesota Cup.
Thank you.
And part of Startup Week. And we have with us Professor Manjeet Rege from the University of St. Thomas. And tell us your department.
Sure. So I'm with the School of Engineering, and I'm with the graduate programs in software within the School of Engineering. And we offer a master's in data science and a recently launched graduate certificate in AI. So this particular topic of podcast kind of directly aligns with what we offer.
Boy, artificial intelligence is going to be our topic by design. We don't have to stick to it, but I'm just wondering. I'm the commoner in the room, right? The lay pedestrian who haven't really dived into this. But I know that in regular consciousness or in regular intelligence, they've talked about multiple intelligences now, so that there are different ways to define intelligence even. So is there an accepted common definition of artificial intelligence?
So as a field...
Okay, the professor, he knows definitions.
As a field, AI has been around for more than 50 years. But in these days, you see a lot of real-world applications of AI. So it is more about having augmented intelligence, like the conversation that we were having earlier.
Our pre-show.
Right, exactly. As opposed to artificial intelligence. So how can we enable enterprises, humans, and make their lives easier by automating a number of processes. So in terms of definition, if you think about automating, I could probably write a program that could be rule-based, so I can hand code a number of rules, and so take this input and then map this to an output. But if that input perhaps mutates or changes a little bit, that same existing logic may not work. So if I have to kind of define AI, it is about coming up or providing with a lot of data to an algorithm, and then that particular algorithm discovers what are the best rules for that input to output mapping. So you're not hard coding or hand coding. You're not writing the logic yourself, but those rules end up getting discovered. Handwriting recognition, self-driving, voice recognition. All of these, you're not writing down the rules by yourself, but those get discovered based on data being provided.
Hmm. Okay. Is that the working definition you use, Scott, in your work? Or?
Right. So when we think about AI in today's marketplace, we think of AI as being augmented intelligence.
Augmented, just improved intelligence.
Yeah, and so when we think about that, and in fact, it influenced how we named our company Equals Three, which is the idea that augmented intelligence is really there is a tool of automation. Augmented intelligence is there to help an individual achieve more in less time. So when we thought about naming equals three, we thought about 1 + 1 = 3, like better than the individual, better than the machine are the two together. And we think it's really important to define what is realistic for AI today, particularly if somebody's buying a solution that talks about being AI, because there is so much disinformation about what AI is. And whether it is simply, you watch a movie or a show, and people want to show this technology as being amazing and going so far into the future that's not practical today. But even the technology providers, I mean, you watch commercials corporate videos for IBM about Watson, or you see Salesforce with Einstein, and they're putting out great works of fiction to try to inspire people about how far ahead they are with their technology. But it is oftentimes they are way beyond their skis and way beyond what is really practiced in the real world. So like when we present our product, Lucy, one of our first slides is to define what is AI and to make sure that people recognize what we can, but also what we can't do. It is, to me, one of our challenges is we'll give demos and we'll show stuff that's pretty amazing. And we'll think, all right, we must have just blown them away. And then they'll think, oh, I was blown away. But then they'll come up with something that's like 8 steps beyond what's practical, because they then take that Hollywood definition of AI, the stuff they've seen in movies, and they're like, oh, if you can do that, you must be able to do this. And they're talking about something that isn't practical for a decade or beyond.
What I know about movies is that if you don't know anything about it, all you know is what you see in the movies or on TV. So then you're distorted. And I thought it was funny that you said that IBM uses fiction to advertise, because I think that's the trouble with advertising. So much of it is fiction.
Well, but I mean, they have really great Watson commercials. But the challenge is somebody watches it and they don't know what Watson does. And they haven't been given any sort of demonstration of what it really does, because they're trying to show something that's kind of fantasy land. And it ends up doing them a disservice. But then the next technology provider sees that and goes, well, we better have something more fantastic than that. Hmm. And they start one-upping themselves in their own creative, but it's not rooted to what they actually do.
Wow. So, Cecily, you are a professional futurist. I mean, I worked in a magazine once, it was in August, and the magazine was for December and was about the future. And by the time the next year came, I thought we'd already had that year. You know, it's kind of a puzzling. So you're not quite in the here and now when you're a futurist.
Oh, I'm very much in the here and now.
You are now?
But
then are you thinking like a futurist? Well, I mean, one of the topics that came up is, and this is the predictive power of human beings when you hear about such a fantastic technology. How is the future going to change? What do you need to know when you're planning for the future about AI? Do you handle that topic?
Yes, I do. And I'll just kind of add my own definition as to what artificial intelligence means.
See, three definitions.
Well, yeah, that if we consider so much of our decision-making routines, you know, we routinize a lot of our lives, and it's very much a kind of if this, then that type of logic,
right,
is what has been programmable. And those programs now exist in many things. And so we are now in a place where some of that programming, the algorithmic coding, also allows the things, these machines, to be responsive and anticipatory. And they respond to us in a way, and this is what we call machine learning. They learn our voice if we're talking to Siri. They learn our preferences, and they begin to anticipate on our behalf where you might take a right turn, if it's time for a coffee this morning, all the things that make our lives typically more efficient, productive, convenient. We love that. And I would say over the span of humankind, that is what we have always done with technology, is that we create the kinds of inventions that make our lives more productive. And that's what these epochs and eras, technological revolutions, have always been about, actually increasing productivity, make our lives more convenient and easy, and opportunities to actually bring more people to the access of that economy.
Boy.
So AI is yet the next revolution in greater ease and convenience and efficiency. It comes with tremendous amount of complexity. We've not been here and at this brink before, but the drive is that. And so I would say, building on the idea of movies and fictions, is that in fact, all of this is a fiction, including the things we dream about. We create fictions of all kinds. So the seed of AI, just like any other technology, is the idea of what would it be like if we could, you know, if I didn't have to pull out a map every time I got in my car, and instead I could wear a watch that nudges me when I'm, you know, making the next left turn, what would it be like? And that we build ourselves into dreams. Man has always done that. What would it be like if we could fly? So fictions are very revelatory and very directive for us. Science fiction does this quite a bit. Novels do this for us. All of what we imagine, I do a lot of visioning and strategy for companies. It's really about doing, I hope, well-informed visions of what's possible and how we build ourselves into it. So it's really just kind of a synthetic comment to building on, you know, what's already been shared.
Well, the thing up, so I'm also the Luddite in the room. I know the least about everything. And also I'm more suspicious of the change because there's one rule of change that that I learned in a technology of media class. And the idea is that for every change, you get something and you lose something. So Socrates and some of the older Greeks, they didn't like the idea of writing because then you would lose your memory. And I think that turned out to be true. You know, it's a way of cheating. And you could call writing an artificial, an augmented intelligence, right? Because you can save ideas, you don't have to think back, and you can communicate them to others. But is change always good in this way, or did we have to keep up on it just in order to control the change?
Well, I think there's a balance, right? If we would like an AI automated software to make our lives easier, we have to contribute something towards it. And that's our own data, our own information about what we like, our preferences. And based on that, so that's a sacrifice that you're making. So that's the change that you have to kind of adapt to.
And there's a sense that you were talking earlier, Scott, about being able to analyze people through the data remnants that they scatter around, their behavior, whatever you can find. You mentioned the idea of analyzing a person's personality.
Yes.
Through these little scraps that you can find.
Yes.
Tell me about that. I mean, that sounds scary to me. Someone's got a label on me and I don't even know what it is.
Well, so those labels can be good for you though, too. And
okay,
I remember, keep
repeating that. Labels can be.
Well, so the internet age has had a constant battle of relevancy versus privacy. And it really has been from day one. I remember when Netscape was first launched and there was this tour with Mark Andreessen and Jim Clarksdale. So these were the earliest guys in the earliest days of Netscape. And they had an event at the Hyatt. And Clarksdale was talking about the internet will be framed around battles of relevancy versus privacy. And 30 years later, it's still absolutely true. And here's what I mean. If you call somebody like for customer service and then they pass you to the next person and you have to repeat your name and your phone number and then to the next person, you're like, don't they already know me? It's driving you crazy. And yet when you get that relevant offer, if you're a loyalist to Apple and you get communications about the latest launch or you call, I'm a Tesla owner. I call Tesla. They immediately, greet me. You know, Mr. Littman, how's everything going? You know, and they're like dialed in on you.
How are your kids and
right,
your new cat?
But the thing is, all of a sudden you're saying, they get me. They know me.
Hmm.
And so if you ask somebody to fill out a survey and say, are you willing to give up your personal information? Absolutely not. Are you okay if big companies know more about you? Absolutely not. And anything you ask about for protecting your data, you want. And yet when you get the offer that is the offer for you, because you want to know, because you're a BMW owner, because you're a Sony enthusiast, because you have a PlayStation, whatever it is, and it's about you, you feel good and you want that. And so even amongst ourselves, we have our own battle of how much do we want to give up versus how much do we want to get, because as consumers, we want that relevancy. We don't want to get spammed with, I'm an iPhone user and why are you giving me a bunch of Android ads? And so the more that Target or Best Buy or marketers know about you so that they can be relevant and know about you and service your needs, they win. And the thing is consumers, we ultimately want that, even though we might not, when asked about it, want to give up that data.
So people are of two minds about that. They want to be known, but they don't want anybody to invade their privacy.
And, you know, I think he makes a very strong point about relevancy that I completely agree with. You know, imagine you're getting some offer in the mail about home equity line of credit or opening up a mortgage, But you're not at that stage in life where you're looking for a home equity line of credit. So that is not relevant to you. So you feel as if your information is being misused. Absolutely. You might have a checking account with that bank, and you feel as if it is being misused. On the other hand, if you happen to be at the time in your life where you're actually looking for a loan, that becomes relevant for you. And you completely forget that it is based on your data that you have parted with, based on which they have been able to predict that you might be an appropriate target in terms of relevancy.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm a gold member of SkyMiles with the Amex card that goes with it. I can't tell you how many times I get offers for their lower end card, and it makes no sense. Hmm. Like, how do they not know that I'm already a cardholder?
So you're and offended. My status?
Absolutely. And they are misusing the data that right. I know they already have on me.
Hmm. Well, there's some glitches. I know, I wrote an op-ed maybe in 2005 about the ads that automatically show up when you're reading an online newspaper or something. And there was a story on Harry Potter wands, and then one of the side ads was about industrial wands for some chemical process. It's like, you know, some AI entity saw a wand, and what's related to wand? Well, you know, went from Harry Potter to that. So it's not always smooth.
No, it's never smooth. Change is not smooth. It's in fits and starts. And all of it is part of an experiment that we learn from. You know, I know that when I first applied for TSA approval, right, you know, that I thought, I don't think I've been fingerprinted since I was born.
Mm.
And it really caused me to, you know, reflect and gasp while at the same time preferring the convenience. And now I use these machines at the airports, which are clear. And again, it's fingerprint and eye recognition, face recognition. And
love clear.
I know.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, and when they first started showing up, I was, you know, like, okay, I want that. Right.
But it's the classic battle of privacy versus how are you going to be served in the way you want to be served.
Well, and this is what we do we most often in the moment will prefer kind of self-interest, convenience, ease over kind of the bigger issues, which, of course, this is where AI is now starting to stretch into. We don't know necessarily what all the implications may be. And there are great concerns about the ethics and morals about who we become as we create these exponential technologies. And exponential technologies are reflect the fact that they build on themselves. Machine learning, for instance, learns faster than we can. And so they run away at an exponential pace. Then we have the opportunity. We don't even have the cognitive capacity to make sense of this while it's happening.
Well, that could be said for a lot of things in the world. Think of the world of politics, but also I know the joke was a while back, I was talking to a professor in medicine at the U, and he says, well, I lost these files. Maybe I can call the NSA and find them. You know, they can they have a document of everything. And for the longest time, I would do as you were saying, Scott, no, you cannot have my data, you cannot have my location. But after a while, I just gave up. You know, they're going to get all my information to make their big data no matter what. So I may as well just give it to them. I bought a Chinese computer figuring they can get it directly, you know.
So. You know, some of this information is already available online. Like, I'll just share one experiment that we did with one of my former grad students. Based on how you tweet online, you can predict. This was the hypothesis that we had. Can we predict what age group do you belong to?
Oh.
So, you know, when you tweet, you make use of a number of abbreviations. And so there are these standard abbreviations that people make use of. So based on what age group you belong, you might have a larger frequency of some of those abbreviations.
Or a larger number of tweets.
Yeah, possibly. Exactly. So we using a Twitter API, we were able to collect a lot of data. And we, of course, needed to have their actual age group known to us so that then we can build a mapping from what they have been typing, what they have been tweeting, to what their actual age is.
Hmm.
And then once you build that model for a new tweet that comes out, you can kind of predict what age category they belong to.
So like a big detective. We're having, instead of, well, Watson, it should be Sherlock. You know, they're out finding everything about us. We're talking here on Synapse Think Tank of the Air, talking about artificial intelligence with three experts in the field, all experts from different angles. Cecily Summers, futurist and author of Think Like a Futurist. And there's a subtitle too. Scott Litman, co-founder of Equals 3, an artificial intelligence-oriented organization. We'll probably find out more about that when we return. And also Professor Manjeet Rege from the University of St. Thomas. We'll be back right after this.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back, Synapse Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau, your host, and with us we have Cecily Summers, a futurist, and serial entrepreneur Scott Litman. We could just talk about your five companies and then go from there. Is it five?
I am on my fifth.
Correct. Okay, and fifth. Okay. So you need an artificial intelligence to count as companies. And we have Professor Manjeet Rege from the University of St. Thomas, also specializing on it. Now, have you been an entrepreneur yourself?
Not yet.
So do you hang around a lot of entrepreneurs?
Sure. So I do a lot of consulting for some companies locally and in terms of AI strategy, data strategy. But I've not been involved in being an entrepreneur myself.
So. Okay. Well, it's catchy. I think it's kind of a syndrome that people get and then they can't help it.
Well, notice that he said not yet.
Exactly.
I think it's speaking to him.
Well, there's so much, seems to be going a boom. Is that your, now you've been in this a long time, I would presume, Scott, the entrepreneurial business is doing startups.
Yeah.
It's a big thing now, but were you in it before it was a hip to do so?
I suppose so. So as I was growing up, my idols were really, you know, Gates and Jobs. And, you know, I studied everything, you know, I could about them and how they were building these kind of, you know, Silicon Valley-based tech sort of organizations, recognizing Microsoft was a bit further north. But, you know, there was a West Coast style to doing business. One of my first jobs was actually to work for Microsoft.
Really?
In a fairly early era of Microsoft's life. And when I graduated from the University of Minnesota, I launched my first startup. And so, you know, at that time, you can turn back and say Minnesota itself has had a tremendous run with entrepreneurs. You know, even if you look at businesses like, you know, a Best Buy started as a, you know, single retail sound of music in St. Paul.
Right.
And, you know, if you go all the way back to James J. Hill, to Pillsbury's, Dayton's, 3M's and the like, you know, we far outclass other parts of the country in the creation of successful entrepreneurs and the businesses they've created. But when we got started, my first business I started in 1991, as much as there was a legacy of entrepreneurism before, and there's been great success since, there wasn't an ecosystem for entrepreneurism. You didn't have necessarily that line of alumni from ventures. You didn't necessarily have systems in place. So, you know, we got started. There were lots of other entrepreneurs that were starting up like we did, but everybody kind of was doing their own thing. Along the way, we created the Minnesota Cup. Along the way, groups like Mini Bar and Mini Demo got created. And over time, more and more organizations started to sprout up to support entrepreneurism. Whereas, you know, where in the last, was a few weeks ago, you had Startup Week, and you had pretty much every hour of every day for 5 days was packed with events, people that are supporters, investors, the entrepreneurs themselves. And so, you know, the critical mass, the ecosystem has changed greatly.
So now,
to make Minnesota a much better place to build businesses. And so for ourselves, this is a great place to build entrepreneurial businesses. It's a great place to be in growth companies. And there's a great history of it. Now there's an ecosystem for it, too.
I was going to say, now, if you're not an entrepreneur, it's like, what's wrong with you? Aren't you with it? And it's also in contrast to, since we had those successful entrepreneurs in the past, we've had all these Fortune 500 companies. And so the typical Minnesotan, I've heard tell, is rather conservative. So they'd rather work at a steady job for all their lives at one of the big companies. And it's just the opposite of jumping out on your own and starting something up.
Well, I mean, entrepreneurism is not for everybody. You know, you have to have a risk threshold that is very different to feel comfortable with it. I know people that have gotten into entrepreneurism and they can't sleep at night. They're too afraid of, my house is on the line. What happens if I fail? And they have to get out of it. So it is not for everybody. And it's okay. It's okay that it is for a limited group of people. And for those people, go for it. And if you're not an entrepreneur, don't feel compelled. You have to be.
And Cecily, how long have you been an entrepreneur?
Always.
So always. You're one of these people that just go out and, well, I know you like to think about things a lot. You were the founder of Push?
Yeah, the Push Institute.
The Push Institute, and that was had a great run for a few years at the Walker Art Center. It was kind of an idea festival, how would you call it?
Well, that sounds wonderful. Yes, I think it was an idea festival. It was, you know, around the kinds of things we're talking about, which is a convening of leaders, thought leaders from around the world and people who are heads of state and entrepreneurs from Rwanda and theoretical physicists, where we would examine themes of change and to give people and organizations in particular an opportunity to, as you said from the beginning, Steve, shift perspective that, you know, it takes time. It's a function of time over several days with that kind of input, where you really begin to see and think differently so that these could be people who could go back to their organizations and begin to think of strategy from a wider point of view and feel fed and nourished and productive. So each year was a different theme of change, and it was really quite a wonderful, yes, idea fest, but it was also very rich with the kinds of inputs and also people who came from around the world.
It was stimulating, but then that changed.
What, right? That it was stimulating
change.
Or
no change that was gone. It disappeared. It no longer exists. It had its time.
That's right. So, you know, we're in a time of fast evolution, aren't we? Where
right.
part of being an entrepreneur is to be sensitive to what those signals are and to take your mission and adapt it.
But you've evolved. You're still on the topic of change, correct?
I have always evolved. And that, again, I think that's really the, you know, evolution is about staying relevant to the context, to the environment.
And survival.
Because you're relevant, right?
You have to adapt.
Yes.
So who are you working for now?
Well, a lot of my work in this last 3 to 4 years has been with Google, where we explored, they reached out to me to ask, what is the future of leadership look like? And this is their executive development group that serves what they call the top of the house, director level and above, which is a small proportion of this 90,000 person organization.
Well, I'm just thinking top of the house, that's got to be a name of a book or a movie, right? The top of the house.
The top of the house,
I work.
Right?
Where do you work? Top of the house.
Yeah.
But I bet you're learning as much as you're teaching.
Oh, of course. You know, every project, every experience is one that shapes me as much as I influence it. So, you know, that's the joy of it. You know, the learning is a thrill. And, you know, I'm able to bring to bear a kind of a model of change, a very clear methodology, and exposure to a lot of different industries at this point. But every project is just a joy of learning. And and I think we do that together.
Well, Professor Rege, your whole life has been learning. I mean, that's what happens when you become a professor, right? You don't stop at the graduation of high school or college. You go to graduate school, and then you're a teacher sharing your learning.
Absolutely. And that's what I tell my students now as well, that that has to be a way of life. You have to be a constant learner. To be able to adapt to the changes that we were talking about earlier. You know, these days we are talking about AI, but, you know, about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that was something that an R&D department did in the basement, and it wasn't something that perhaps people looked at that had a real-world application.
But it wasn't top of house.
Exactly. So now it is everywhere. And so if you are able to adapt to changes by being a constant learner, I think you will be top of the house.
I have to ask you a question because I know examples from my lifetime. When I went to school, they taught things that are now known to be wrong. Did you have that experience? Did they teach you things when you were an undergrad that you now know? No, that's it. Now they're saying the opposite.
Well, my undergraduate was in mathematics.
Mm-hmm. So those numbers are...
So those things haven't changed.
Pretty solid...
Right.
Bet.
So I cannot really think about examples that were, I would say, wrong as such.
Mm-hmm.
But things in machine learning have kind of evolved from the traditional machine learning that used to be.
Now, what's machine learning? I can guess.
Right.
But it's like, is it a robot? That's what you think of.
So if you think about AI, since we've had one definition, I'll give you another
one. Yeah, we need more.
So if you think about AI as a broader field, like physics, machine learning is a set of tools within that. So it could be like, you could think about machine learning as Newton's laws within that.
Hmm. Can you give me an example of machine learning?
Sure. So now, let me just step back and then talk about AI first a little bit. So
okay.
AI, the goal of AI is to develop applications, software, which are more human-like. Now, you know, we were talking about movies and myths and fiction. So that is the overall goal or the overall vision of that particular field. Within AI, machine learning are a set of tools or a set of algorithms that are able to or that are helping us enable that eventual dream. So applications such as a self-driving car, Google Homes or the Alexas, all of these have certain intelligent software embedded in that, which have been made possible by machine learning algorithms. So there you go. So basically, machine learning is one particular, I would say, aspect of AI that is helping us automate things quickly.
Hmm. The one thing I guess I notice is Google, because if you Google something, it tends to know what you're looking for. It tends to know you're in the Twin Cities. It tends to know all these. It has these assumptions.
That is because we have already partnered. We have the trade-off. We have given your data to them.
All right. I've opened up my cupboards. It has all my data.
Exactly.
I don't. It's like I don't care anymore.
Right. But thinking about change, what has also changed within AI and ML, machine learning, is that it wasn't as accessible to a traditional software developer or an engineer in the past. It was more accessible to a PhD research scientist, all of these machine learning algorithms. Now, with a lot of higher level APIs, you have an undergraduate student.
API?
That's an application programmer interface. So you have an undergraduate student, you know, writing programs that are invoking higher-end artificial intelligence algorithms. So it is now much more accessible. And as a result, you have a number of startups coming up from everywhere because of these intelligent applications. The field of software engineering has kind of evolved from being software engineering to engineering intelligent software all around us.
Hmm. So,
it's a good lead in for us. I mean, at Equals 3, we've built a marketing AI called Lucy. And it wouldn't have been possible for us to do this 5 years ago. But as companies like Microsoft and IBM and others started to put components out into the marketplace that were these AI components, they became building blocks where you could say, you know, I want this component from Microsoft. I want these three from IBM, from Watson. I'm going to get this from, you know, another stack. And you can put together an architecture. And a way of thinking about this is, you know, for people that have been building software for years, there are times they might go out and get a component. Maybe they want a user authentication component. So rather than writing one from scratch, they can pick from various libraries and pick something that's already been done, something that has had a tremendous amount of testing and is extremely robust. And so now they're thinking about, since I have user authentication, what am I doing on top of it? Where am I adding value? Well, we do the same thing with, particularly in the earliest stage for us with AI, we started with a bunch of components from some different stacks, a lot of Watson stuff. We were able to test out some hypothesis.
And Watson is the IBM.
Right. When people talk, when IBM promotes Watson, they are promoting a giant bucket of pieces and parts. But it's a, these are, you know, building blocks.
It doesn't
sound
too romantic when you phrase it like that.
No, but I mean, they are, you know, in technology terms, they are APIs and services that developers can use to build applications. And you don't have to build all Watson stuff. You can use components from various technology libraries. But the benefit is A developer can prototype something. They can build a beta of something very quickly. Now, in our case, we have replaced some of those components with things that are our own logic and IP. We've sometimes replaced one component for another component. We've built all kinds of customizations. We've built a knowledge graph. We've built understandings of the intents and utterances of users to work against certain data sets. These are all things that we're doing to add value that make us very unique. But in the very core, we have these components that had we been the ones to build them, you would spend millions and millions of dollars just trying to build the underlying components versus the millions of dollars on how to use these components in unique ways and deliver really powerful value to the marketplace.
So what we were doing
was not possible 5 years ago because those underlying components didn't exist in a way that developers could use them. But today, you get this tremendous jumpstart. You know, IBM has invested billions into AI. Microsoft has invested billions into AI. And for developers, their starting point is leveraging those billions into components that they can pick up for peanuts.
Well, it almost sounds easy, but I know that it's not. But
no,
I was thinking
you still have to do a tremendous amount of work above and beyond those building blocks.
Well, I was thinking of having to make your own tools, like putting in a wall. You know, you don't have to make your hammer; you can just go buy your hammer. But if you had to make the hammer and get all the steel and mine the iron ore, that's a huge effort. But now you just buy a hammer or a screwdriver or electric screwdriver, AI screwdriver.
You know, just to give you an example, when I was working on my PhD more than 10 years ago, a lot of the research was kind of closed. Every individual researcher had to either gather his own data set or, if somebody else is willing, if any other researcher was willing to share his code, you could use that and perhaps build on top of that. But now, within the past, I would say, less than 10 years, there's a lot of openness. So you have standardized data sets. So if one company or one researcher ends up coming up with a newer kind of an algorithm, they can go and try it out on that benchmarking data set. You have all of that code available on one particular centralized place where, a number of students can go and access that real-world code, which has been used live in a number of applications. So as a result, when you have, a lot of these components that, Scott was talking about, it gives you a start. And then and you can capitalize on that and then, kind of build your own IP around it.
I know one instance that I've seen of the use of technology, I'm just asking, is this AI or not? The idea of kind of creating a simulated animal so you can test products with computer simulations instead of taking out the rabbit and shaving it and putting some lotion on it and seeing if it hurts or not, if it turns red.
It requires
AI?
Not exclusively AI. I mean, most of the things that we're creating are a convergence of many different technologies and capabilities. And the most powerful ones, of course, one of the things I think about is where AI and biotechnology meet. And that, I think, is actually a very powerful force for our future. But what you're describing now talks about virtual reality as well. There's a kind of 3D modeling and, effectively storyboarding that you can do. But AI is in that picture. Some of it. You know, Google, everybody's doing this now, but in 2016, they declared that they were preparing for an AI-first world. So,
and I don't know what that means.
What that means is that every technology, nearly everything we use, will have a layer of AI in it, so that there will be all of the things that, again, we're already using. It's like the old Palmolive commercial with Madge the manicurist, who will be talking about her the dishpan hands and said, "Palmolive is good for your hands." What do you mean, good for my hands? You're soaking in it.
So we're soaking in AI.
We are already soaking in AI.
I mean, think about that every day. If you open up Facebook, there's AI that's telling you what is the message you should see. When you use Google, which we think of, maybe some people think of still as a search engine, you're having a conversation. I mean, you start thinking, I'm not quite sure, how do I say this? And you just start talking to Google. And Google is amazing at understanding that natural language and bringing back the answer that you want. When you use Google Maps to figure out where am I going, all these things are fueled by AI, and it's become incredibly commonplace.
And they know you like coffee, so it's going to show you the coffee places. We're here on Synapse Think Tank of the Air. Boy, we're thinking, we're artificially thinking, I think. We're going beyond that. We're here with futurist Cecily Summers, entrepreneur Scott Littman, and Professor Marjeet Rege. We'll be back right after this.
Synapse Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back here on Synapse Think Tank of the Air talking artificial intelligence and using a lot of the real stuff, I might add. But one of the fears of the advent of artificial intelligence is the jobs that will be displaced. You hear that all the time. And Scott, we talked about this a couple of years ago, and you were saying, boy, it's a good time to be an actor. I don't know if you remember that story. Do you still believe that, or can you tell that story?
Yeah, I can. So, you know, here's the broader context is this. Think about in the United States, we think about jobs. And if you turn back the clock 100 years, about 50% of the jobs were in agriculture. And as automation took place, as machines could do more and more work and less labor was needed by hand, people started to congregate more into cities. They started to take on more factory jobs. As automation evolved, you started having fewer factory jobs because fewer people were needed, and you see a boom in the service economy. Where it goes next is a challenge because you're starting to see in some segments that the services economy is being impacted by automation as well. If you go to a market like Japan, where they have issues of not enough young people to do some of the jobs to service an older generation, you start looking at the fast food place that has levels of automation, so one or two people can do what used to be the work of many. So you have to start thinking about what are the things that people should be thinking about for future employment that'll be at less risk for automation. You know, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. If a business can buy an automated system that allows it to be more efficient, it will. And there's nothing wrong with that. But there has been, in all these waves of technology, there's been a level of displacement. So even to the point where people say, well, go into STEM, which I believe in, other than there are some developers saying, you know, we're going to start to see automation in code that's going to reduce the needs for developers. You look at Google and, you know, the number of people that need to maintain a data center is incredibly low, even though it might be a huge facility servicing billions of dollars in revenue and, you know, billions of customers. So my business partner, he was telling me how one of his kids was going into acting. And I said, that is a fairly future-proof scenario. And whether his son ends up being an actor, a producer, a writer, there's all sorts of things that fall into that creative space. And they are in an area that will be very late to be impacted, if not impacted for, you know, for a foreseeable future, because we still need to have, we all enjoy stories. We all enjoy these productions, and you need people behind them. Even when you see, you know, an amazing Pixar animated movie, the number of people that work on it is immense. And it's not just the voice talent, but the you know, all the work and the producers, the directors, the animators. And so these creative arts, my belief is, are fairly insulated from the impacts of automation, and that there's actually more creation of opportunity there versus, you know, you go into a field like legal and the impact on lawyers for...
We can replace lawyers?
We can't replace lawyers, but how do lawyers start out? They start out in discovery.
Do all the research.
The big law firms hire armies of lawyers coming out of college for discovery. But when you have e-discovery that makes that so much more efficient, where you need far fewer starting lawyers, there is a very real impact.
Well, I don't know if that's good or bad, having fewer lawyers.
And paralegals and that kind of thing. We already have, you know, like Zoom legal, and there's a lot of people write their own wills and divorce decrees and all of that.
Well, thanks to the internet, you can download templates for all these things.
That's right. So right. The point being that we've been watching it and experiencing it in motion for some time already. It's not a flip of the switch. It's a kind of a gradual shift faster than a generation. And so there is a big question about how do we educate people, how do we train them, and which jobs might we invest in, you know, kind of gamble in that are going to be relevant, where there's going to be some kind of economic payoff, because it's, there's a lot that's shifting now.
Right. I heard
there's a lot of hype as well about AI, right? I mean, when we talk about jobs getting eliminated, I think Scott made a really good point about there will be jobs that will be displaced. So you'll have different kinds of jobs. If you think about Amazon probably affecting a lot of other retail stores and the jobs impacted by that. But at the same time, to serve its e-commerce business, Amazon has large warehouses. Within those warehouses, a lot of the low-level work in heavy lifting is done by automated robots. But then you also have employees as a second layer after that to do a lot of other intelligent navigation of those products being shipped. So you have a lot of, when you look at surveys coming out, you have other kinds of jobs that are getting generated as a result of AI. Some of the lower level jobs will get displaced. So I think that goes back to our earlier point. You have to be a constant learner to be able to adapt to this change.
Hmm. Yeah, and to that end, and I used very consciously the word automation, and I gave examples of factory automation and things like that. And automation has a strong history of displacement. But I think about in the knowledge space, like we're working in with AI for marketers, we have great examples where we can already see where very tedious, repetitive, boring tasks, things that take many hours, are turning into minutes. But what we're seeing is that because people can get the data together in minutes, they're now using those people resources to think about what are the insights they get from the data? What are the actions they take? Automation is getting rid of some of the most tedious and routine stuff, but the displacement there is how do I use my brain and how do I do more intelligent things with the data? And the other thing is there's been, like in our space, there's been such an explosion of data. There's a stat that over the last 2 years, there's more data created than all of time before. And
but see, and I go, what does that mean? I can't even think of it. But
no,
it's data, but is it knowledge?
Well, that's the challenge. And so the thing is, if I have this explosion of data, it's expected I know how to use it. And the problem is, without the assistance of some of these tools like an AI tool, I can't make sense of it. I can't use it all. So I'm expected to use it all, but I can't.
So
it becomes
a requirement
to take advantage of all of the data effectively. Oftentimes it's the advance of these types of tools so that people can effectively do their jobs and leverage everything that they're supposed to have in those data assets.
So to try to interpret that mountain of data for usable purposes.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, using these AI tools or machine learning algorithms to discover something from the data and then eventually to be able to present that data to an executive who might not have the same level of machine learning or AI expertise that a data scientist might have, in a manner that that person can perhaps consume and understand that data. So you might use the best of the algorithms out there, but if you cannot communicate that data effectively to a decision maker, then there is no point in doing all of that hard work. So that is why we talk about data story and the data dashboard. So
the data story, I don't know that one.
So when you build a dashboard, which is an interactive experience about the data behind, right? So imagine you have all of these charts and an executive would like to go and click on each one of them, change some parameters to make sense of that data. But somebody puts you directly in the cockpit of a plane and you see all of these gauges, you don't know, you're a little bit overwhelmed. So in Tableau, for example, which is a data visualization tool, you can build a story before it, which is kind of like a few series of visualizations that kind of lead you to that dashboard. So as an executive, I would perhaps get overwhelmed directly to interact with that dashboard, but give me some insights about that data so that I become familiar. And then eventually when I arrive at the dashboard, so it's like some kind of a prep time. And then when I arrive at the dashboard, I'm now well prepared to go and interact with that dashboard.
So there's learning all the way through.
Well, the value, I think, what he's suggesting is that you have to extract meaning from the data. And so there's interpretation, insight, and application. And so the skills required to, you know, present that in mm-hmm. a way that can have meaning for people who are not data analysts is what this dashboard presents.
Right.
And we all, you know, we all get certs that up. I mean, a lot of our interfaces do that for us. There's a whole back end that we never see. But I think what the suggestion is that that skill is very high value and will continue to be. There's a big socioeconomic impact here, however, which is everything that we're talking about that will we believe will continue to have value in terms of jobs requires a good amount of education and background. And so as we know,
unlike agriculture 100 years ago,
not right? today, right? So there's, you know, there is polarization is one of the themes of our time. And education is one of the way that is already polarized in terms of access. And
even science is polarizing.
Well,
these
indeed.
Days.
Yes, indeed. But
the interpretation of science.
But I'm talking about economic some. Impact.
Whether right it now. Exists yeah. or not.
No, everything. Everything is that, you know, there is a... That's what happens when things get so disrupted we don't know what to do is we kind of white knuckle what we do know to be true, which very often is the past. So we get entrenched in wanting to pull back to an earlier time.
Luddites.
Well, no, not Luddites.
No, romantics?
Well, there is a sense of romance in that, but it really is just that we have a gap right now, a gap of understanding. So we cling to the things we do understand, even when they are no longer relevant.
Wow.
And you know, I'll just leave with this, is that, you know, the for instance, politically, that's what we see in the U.S. We were built this way to have two sides, two interpretations of what we believe government's job to be, rest on two interpretations of human nature.
Couldn't there be, you know, one thing that's puzzled me a lot about politics is that the people that run, oftentimes it's like, who do they think they are, that they know more than everyone else and they can run everything and they're just out for power? Why don't we have a search for a president where we put all this artificial intelligence pouring through? You can find their personalities, their strengths and weaknesses, find one
that
instead of...
really frightening, by the way.
Well, so that's it. Where what we have now is pretty frightening, I think.
Absolutely.
You know, what's the alternative? But where is then the difference? I mean, part of this whole conversation, even just by using the word intelligence, you're going on metaphor off of humans. It's like we're shaving the things that machines can do better than we can. What's left? What is a human being that's after you AI everything else away?
Well, this has been the what we refer to as progress as humans, is that technology has always been pruning away certain things that we have done for ourselves, and we have invented largely tools and machines that start to do some of it for us. And so now we're into the arena of cognition with our tools. You know, are there things that can think with and for us and augment us? And this has been a really juicy and acute question of what is human after all, still and abiding, or is it? So can, you know, one of the, you know, I would say polarizing or just energetic conversations that happens now is, can we reverse engineer consciousness and make conscious machines? And certainly people will argue for or against that, whether we should or shouldn't, or whether it's even possible.
Or what is consciousness in the first place? They haven't figured that out.
Yes. And that's a very juicy conversation. I would go there with you in a second. But for this conversation... The piece about what is human, I will argue that one of the things that we need more of right now to kind of balance the picture of technological advancement is that which is best of our distinctly human capacities, and that is humility, morality, and wisdom. We have to, after all, still, this may not always be true, but what we know today is that we still are the ones who are exercising judgment. So if we can intentionally evolve our discernment, our morality, our wisdom to keep pace with the environment that we're in, this is how we must evolve to stay relevant, how humans must evolve to stay relevant, because it, after all, it is still the effect of our own making. We are creating the world out of our imagination.
Yeah, but haven't you ever watched Twilight Zone? All the machines take over. I mean, there's that fear.
There is that fear, and it's not, it is within the realm of possibility, which is why the big action, in my opinion, is this one of actually, we want to go into, I believe, or to live not just an examined life, but also start to form an examined future. Hmm. And the two are yoked to one another. Hmm. We have to know our own capacities in order to know what we can build and to do so thoughtfully.
Well, our capacity is time. We have just a couple minutes left, but do you want to say how you're human and not artificial?
Sure. So I think in terms of what is left in AI and the path ahead, last 5 or 6 years have seen a lot of advancement in the field of AI, but I think we are still far off from generalized human intelligence. So for example, the algorithm that runs in a self-driving car is different, or it cannot prepare coffee for me. The algorithm might perhaps prepare the coffee for me, cannot do a lot of other things. So, you know, so you have advancements being done for particular tasks, but a human can do all of those things together.
Hmm.
So that is why I think we are far off from generalized human intelligence. So there is fear, but nothing immediate.
Hmm. Okay, so you can stay calm because you can make coffee and drive.
Exactly.
So, Scott, do you have any final words on your humanity? Where's your humanity?
So you
look like you're praying there with your hands folded.
No, well, I was just thinking through it. So I really like your definition. I think that it makes a ton of sense. And I feel like we are light years away from Hollywood. And that's a good thing. It's okay. We are immersed in this AI stuff that's affecting all that we do. And yet it is always in a point solution that solves a specific problem, and one where we were the ones that defined what it would do for us. Hmm. It doesn't define what it does back.
So we're still controlling the machines.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. I can pause now with some relief and humility and assurity and creativity. That's one of the things you mentioned, too. We're still in control of creativity. So we'll write the scripts for Hollywood, even though Pixar can pixelate them. Well, thanks for joining us on this talk. Cecily Summers, you recommended the idea as a topic, artificial intelligence. She's a futurist and the author of Think Like a Futurist. So it's like you have to practice what you preach every day. And Scott Littman, serial entrepreneur, right now the co-founder of Equals 3, also co-founder of Minnesota Cup, which is, that's had a successful run. It's doing great.
We just completed our 14th year.
Wow. How much money did they give away this year?
This year we had $500,000 in prizes.
Holy cow. Compared to what the first year? Like
$37,500. It has evolved significantly.
Boy.
And over the last 14 years, we've had almost 14,000 participants. The top finishers have raised, through exits or investment, over $250 million.
Well, I think you co-founded a good thing.
Thank you.
And Professor Manjeet Rege, what's the next class you're teaching?
So I'm teaching, right now a class in machine learning, which is a step towards the next class, which is artificial intelligence.
Oh.
So I teach those two classes as well as data analytics and visualization. So we spoke about, you know, earlier best practices for having an interactive dashboard and how do you visually communicate the data. So that course talks about that. So people can learn more about that at stthomas.edu/software.
Okay. And just one final question for you. When you become an entrepreneur, do you have a name for your new company?
Not yet, but I think I'm going to ask Equals 3. What I'll do is I'll just ask Lucy what the best name should be.
Hey, we can all work together.
And then based on my personality, Lucy can probably make a recommendation.
That's right, and get some consultation from Cecily here. Okay, sure. Well, thank you all for joining us here on Synapse Think Tank of the Air. I'd like to thank Dan Culhane, our producer, and also this is a co-production with WCCO Radio. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. I'm Leo Espinosa.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.